Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm the Von Trapp family chorus sacrificing pool filters to Boney M's backup baritone for this episode.
That's the most baroque you've ever gone there, Richard.
And becoming increasingly baroque now is the Horns of Nymon.
Horns of Nina Simone, just to continue with a musical theme.
So as our resident podcast classicist, can I go all professorial
and
on
hater.
You?
Yes, please. Please do.
So this is obviously a reworking of the story of Theseus and the Minotaur. And once again, as we found in Underworld, in the future, space myths are merely anagrams of our normal Greek myths.
That's right.
And so
space myth.
So we have Aneth instead of Athens, yes. We have Skonos instead of Knossos, which is city in Crete. We have Krinoth, which is an anagram of Corinth, which was the other sort of major city in Greece. Soldeed is just Daedalus, who
yes,
is the...
rather than King Minos, he is definitely Daedalus.
Yeah, well, Daedalus creates the labyrinth, and Nymon is, of course, a sort of anagram of the beginning of the word Minotaur.
And Sot, does he come in? Is an anagram of Tos?
Well, no, Seth is an anagram of Theseus.
Yes.
You know, so it is, I don't know who Tinker is.
Does he come in?
No, Frank. Tinker.
And what? Tish?
What about Sorak? Who's Sorak?
No idea. But
Sergeant Benton. That's who I thought it was when I was a kid.
There is more to it than that, because what many people don't know, having read, you know, children's book versions of the Minotaur, is they don't know how the Minotaur came about.
So well, Minotaur, some of us do. What rating do we have for this episode?
Well, I'm going to try and be a bit coy about it, but King Minos' wife, Pasiphae, was afflicted with an unnatural...
urge,
and so she made herself a cow out of wicker work and climbed into it.
Out of Edward Woodward.
And then, yes. And then allowed herself to be pleasured by yes. a bull. And
well,
so the Minotaur is actually...
We've all been to Crete.
Sick. That's it, under the influence of Uzo, what wouldn't you do? Mm. So the Minotaur is in fact like a symbol of just the darkest sexual desires of the human mind. And it's no coincidence that it lives inside a dark, cavernous labyrinth.
It's
you know,
the shadow self. Isn't he also representative of, as the true nature of the shadow, is the urge to live? It's the urge to recreate, to move above the mundane, to the essence of life itself. If we talk about the great journey of life, then perhaps, as Jung would describe the shadow, is if without your shadow, you're simply lachrymose, you just fall into disinterest.
So About Time says that the original myth of the Minotaur is a tale of everything animalistic and Freudian in human consciousness, but that this is about a bull-headed alien who fires energy bolts from its horns and lives in some space corridors.
I wasn't aware of that origin of the Minotaur. And, well, it just appears now I have a whole new appreciation for Corey Bernardi, because he's actually just trying to protect us from Minotaurs.
Yes, clearly.
As well
Corey
as...
Corey Bernardi, our senator in South Australia, who says that if you have gay marriage in Australia, for our overseas listeners, it will lead to bestiality.
Exactly.
That's so why we call him Corgi Bernardi.
Yes, that's right. So that's right. He's protecting us from Nymon and women in trousers.
Is that why when Soldeed finally passes away, he giggles? As he dies, is that why?
Because he's falling on Corey Bernardi.
Because he was enjoying this as much as... I love this story. Can
I just say? I do too.
I love this
story. And me.
And we should vote also. Graham MacDonald sent notes really early on to Tony Reid, to Anthony Reid, and to Gray Williams, saying, this is the best script of the season so far. Yes, I know. It's City of Death. He said, Graham MacDonald said, this makes perfect sense to me.
Well, the thing is...
Classically, because he sat on a Corinthian column while he said it, you know.
If you're looking for action-adventure and monsters and interesting situations and characters getting split up and having individual plots and adventures of their own, then Horns of Nymon is superior to
it
City
is.
Of Death in
it
that
is
way.
It is superior to all of them. I saw a beautiful piece of embroidery on the interweb today. It was that little birds flying around. It was like the thing that Judi Dench does, and it just said in lovely cursive script, if you're brave enough, everything is a dildo. And I think that's what Graham MacDonald, as head of BBC Loveliness, was saying down there, he said, this, inserted into this season, is the finest piece of release I can possibly achieve through your scriptings, Mr. Douglas Adams.
There's very funny things happening on the sixth floor.
Isn't that how you're being served? Didn't they have the sixth floor as where that, you know, you've done it in...
So, you know, management was up on the sixth floor, yes. And that was a BBC reference, yes. Because management was on the sixth floor of, yes, Television Centre, which has now been demolished by the Tories.
And should we also mention that, is that another reference of why Tom Whack, Janet Ellis on the bum in this one?
I didn't notice possibly. That.
Did you notice that? Yes. There's, again, to continue bum references, we get a lovely split trouser scene from the Despicable Worm Guard.
Oh.
And there were no...
it's Weakling Scum. Mm, oh, yeah, no, he gets called the Despicable Worm. Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Yes. Do you remember there was a fan edit of this?
Yes, it was done by Peter Griffiths and...
Simon Moore, I think?
Yes, Simon Moore.
Can we find it? Because I do remember this.
we could ask them. When we were kids, this was a joke. Everyone thought this story was really terrible, the worst thing ever.
Yeah.
And you remember...
as fashionable young adults.
Well, yes. There was that reaction once Nathan Turner came along and we got into next year's stories. Everyone thought that Graham Williams' stuff was rubbish. And, you know, even Doctor Who magazine kind of was taking that as its party line as well. So we all knew that we were in this glorious new era of the 80s. And that the late 70s had been really terrible. And so the Horns of Nimon was this joke, and they cut together this thing, which was really quite funny, and they used to show it at conventions and fan meetings. But most of the big laughs came, in fact, from lines that were intentionally meant to be funny in Horns of Nimon by the people who created it.
And as I seem to recall, I think it was Peter Griffiths once told me, that it was a 60-minute edit... because they had a 60-minute take to hand when they started. Because, of course, you know, all of this was on double VHS deck, using a mixing desk, what have you. It comes up, The Horns of Nimon by Anthony Reed, part one. And then The Horns of Nimon, Anthony Reed, part one, crossed out, part two. Sorry, we only had the omnibus edition. And despite the fact that they only have 60 minutes, they constantly reuse that clip of Graham Crowden wandering down a corridor, Lord Nimon! Lord Nimon, it is I, Sol Deed.
I think they also repeatedly have the guard from episode one walking through and calling the Anethans weakling scum, yes, as well. Although that does actually happen over and over again in the episode.
And they immensely improve the co-pilot's bleatings when he's begging the Nimon to spare him at the end of episode three by having Peter Griffith's voiceover. This scene has a terrible performance, so we're going to talk over it by pointing out that if you look here in 10 seconds, Porky's trousers are going to split. Which they do as he dies.
It really is Doily Cart doing Doctor Who, isn't it? If Gilbert and Sullivan had simply been co-writers of Douglas Adams, I don't think we would have got a different story.
Well,
just with a few more coloratura moments from Graham Never the Doctor Crowden. Get a window into how, because I suppose everyone knows that Graham Crowden was up for the fourth Doctor.
Yes.
Yeah, I think
Do we get an impression of how he would have played it had he simply been cast? Can you imagine? Because he was known for playing wacky Doctors, and he did again with Peter Davison in Very Peculiar Practice, of course.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think he would have played it a bit more like Peculiar Practice, because Peculiar Practice...
I want him to do it in that outfit, in the whole
collar
cape.
Yeah.
Because Peculiar Practice, he's a very eccentric character, but his delivery is very straight. It's just what he says is very eccentric, and I think that's how he would have played the Doctor. Right. Much like he is in Waiting for God.
Yeah.
You know, in Waiting for God, he says outrageous and ridiculous things, but with bearing and gravitas. You know, like he's woken up from a daydream and says, I was just climbing up the Himalayas with Oscar Wilde. And Stephanie Cole, who is the other lead in that series, would say, oh, you're an old fool, etc. Have you seen Waiting for God?
No, I've never seen it.
It's really quite wonderful. You know, as much as I love As Time Goes By is a bit saccharine, whereas Waiting for God is just too... old people who, they've just had enough and their children have shunted them into this nursing home, which is run by Chris Parsons.
Oh, really?
Oh, we'll get
to more of this next week. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Back to the Horns of Nymon. No, look, I love this one.
While we're going on old lovies, isn't it terrific to see just how far Professor Waterfield would go to get away from his daughter?
Yes, he's...
John Bailey.
Season. John Bailey is Edward Waterfield.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Doctor, you're not still travelling with Victoria? I don't blame you for a second.
He's great,
isn't
actually.
He good? Oh. And you're talking about gravitas. He really gives us that whole thing of, you know, the highs and lows, as you're referencing in Greek tragedy. I think he's the best thing in it.
I think he may be the guest performer of the season, possibly second to Myra Francis.
I think they should have had their own spin-off, don't you? Speaking of sitcoms with Stephanie Cole and...
Because that's where the story really, really gets scary. And
Myra Francis, referencing her, I'm terrified. But it is, isn't it? It's beautifully, beautifully done, beautifully done.
So I've got a bit of a memory about that episode, if I might share it. This is another one that I didn't have on videotape until I was about 12, I think. And the ABC
Which is when we saw it, really, first time. Yeah. We were about the same age. Yeah.
And the ABC were repeating it in the afternoons. And so I taped episode 1 and 2, and episode 3 was the next day. And some of my cousins were visiting, Leah and Daniel. And I quite treasure this story because Daniel is sadly no longer with us. And we were out having a walk. And I suddenly realised that it was 5:15 and Doctor Who was on at 5:30 or something like that. And Daniel said, we've got to get back. Daniel was about 5 years older than me. We've got to get back. And so we ran home.
Well, he should have known better, shouldn't he, being 5 years older? But anyway.
So we ran home, and my mum had remembered to record it, which was quite a momentous moment in itself because she wasn't very good with the VCR. And so we got there just at the end. So I rewound the tape to watch it, and Daniel went off to do something else. I said, don't you want to watch this? And he said,
I'm 15. I'm a 15-year-old boy. I've got a lot of things to do in my room apart from watching Doctor Who.
Well, that's the thing. He said, oh, no, I don't like Doctor Who. I just didn't want you to miss it.
Oh, isn't that lovely?
He didn't beat you up for making
you come home and watch Doctor Who. See, that's what nice 15-year-olds were like. You're going to say you changed his life and he just absolutely loved Doctor Who.
No. That's just a little window.
Well, I used to try and proselytize. I used to try and induct others' children, and I still have the scars to prove it. How about yourself, Nathan? You still do that, don't you? You still enable youth.
Well, yeah, no, we have a Doctor Who club at school. Yes. We're watching...
And I know some of your students listen, so hello, Nathan's Doctor Who
club. Hello, and I hope that all my other lovely things that I've said on this podcast still get through.
We're cutting them all out.
Most of it gets cut, so, you know. Look forward to the unexpurgated version of your 18th birthday.
So that scene with Sizom on the planet Krynoth.
Sizom.
So it's a little bit like Inferno, isn't it? Where we go to a parallel world where the disaster has played out and we get to see what Nymon has in store for it. But it's what they later do in The Simpsons in Marge versus the Monorail, where Marge goes to North Haverbrook to find the disaster that's been wrought on that town
Minotaur. Is.
And there's that guy who's like Sizom, the guy who stops to have a haircut and then rushes
she
back.
She was the doctor.
She
all
was the doctor
time.
All along.
And Matt Groening is a Doctor Who fan.
Yes, he is. Yes. A massively major Doctor Who fan. I was just going to say, of course, I mean, the obvious, you know, lodestone in the room, that if there's no question, Chris Chibnall's, if you want a female doctor, you just cast Lala Ward again. She's already played it.
I'm too excited by the prospect of Olivia Colman as Doctor Who.
With David Tennant as what? Saul the Flying Church.
Yeah, something like that.
As a regenerated Donna.
There is talk about that, but that's for not now. That they're trying to get Catherine Tate interested in this show, but that could just be a chat.
I love how Catherine Tate, even after being in the show for a year, knows nothing about it.
No, she thinks the Daleks are still in every single episode.
Yeah. And she, my favourite Catherine Tate moment is when she was on Nevermind the Buzzcocks. Before I did the show, I thought his name was Mr. Who, and he went to university, and he became a doctor.
savant, the whole thing.
I think she's just playing a part there.
I don't know.
I got the impression from those commentaries that she is devastatingly intelligent.
She is. Can be in your own universe and still be devastatingly intelligent, which is, I suppose, through a black hole where Nymons... for goodness sake, who dresses the Nymons? I mean, really, did they work all of that out
from Top of the Pops?
Did you know they were meant to be hideously ugly beasties that couldn't bear their own visage, so
they put bulls' heads on?
Well, they had the beautiful ornate masks that actually covered their whole upper torsos, which is very interesting if you like it in a post-Star Trek universe, that these creatures were so real-like that they presented a beautiful golden mask, Agamemnon-like golden mask, but they were actually Medusae.
Right, maybe.
Medusae underneath. Very much more interesting. And that the dancers, because, you know, they were hired, the dancers in cork wedgies, it's in 3-foot platform heels. Imagine how your mothers suffered, boys who are listening.
I'm beginning to wonder whether those are Cathernoi, you know, the...
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, those things, the boots that are associated with Greek tragedy, you know, I wonder why that's why they're wearing the high heels.
I think it's just because it's a bit of flash.
Yeah, no, probably.
But then again, every generation has its 79, doesn't it? I think that the idea is lovely, and I like to think, even watching this, I thought, no, you're not bulls, you're something else underneath. And it just triggered a response when I was reading that. Oh, yeah, I think as a boy, we never read them as being bulls in leggings. I think we thought that they were wearing something else. Well, you can see how the carapace stops at the back.
They've got a lot of side bottom, too, in those outfits.
That's a terrific term.
A fair amount
this episode gives you a great deal of sideway leers and side bottoms, doesn't it?
They've got great voices.
And hats. There are some terrific hats. And yes, their voices are great.
Yeah, they're really good. They come back in, what, Seasons of Fear or something?
Yes, I was just going to say, as my pick of this episode, please listen to Paul Cornell's early Big Finish Eighth Doctor. It's a terrific story.
And then Nymon are perfect to bring back on audio because they sound great.
I didn't guess it was them.
Yeah. No, I didn't either.
No, nor did I.
The Mithraic cult. Because they were just, you know, the Nymon were actually challenging the early Western world as against Christianity, because Mithraism could have easily become the alternate religion other than Christianity. We could have all been worshipping Nymon as we speak, and perhaps in a small way we are.
Yeah.
Well, Nathan, you're
quite literally
in those platforms that he's wearing right now. Usually, Brendan and I that frock up, but you've done a lovely job this week.
I am wearing Soldi's hat as well, as you can see.
I actually like the other bloke's hat. Sorak. I can never remember.
Sorak.
Yeah, he just looks like he's going to do a lovely Steve Strange fade to grey moment for us all.
Well, I love his sleeves. Mm. They're great.
Panto sleeves. Do you know it was really heavy?
Silk
and velvet pressed onto foam rubber, and it cost a fortune. The BBC were promoting the story for its cosiness.
Yeah, well, and of course...
So it's definitely a frock show.
He used to fall over between takes, and he couldn't get up.
Yeah.
It's in Pixley.
Tom was cruelly using him as a beanbag.
The costumes, of course, are...
Get off me, you're very heavy.
June Hudson.
Yeah, that's why she's fabulous.
That's why Romana looks so great.
That's why Romana is dressed in her hunting pinks, which of course ladies only wear black when they go hunting. But she's wearing hunting pinks, and I think it's definitely June's thinking, alternate doctor. Well, you know, it was that Tom was busy doing other things, and that's why he's not in those scenes with Professor Waterfield. It's actually, Tom was meant to go.
Oh, right.
But for whatever reason, during rehearsals or script-wise, they gave Lala more work.
No, she's great in it, too.
I think it's quite wonderful, yeah. And this is...
She's superb.
This is actually a very good point for a visit from an obelisk.
I actually quite like this story. However, Tom Baker is out of control by this stage. But do you think it's because he's actually trying to compensate for all of the production values that aren't going right? But there are other things in this that I think work quite well. I actually really like the Nymon, and I think this is a tour de force for Lala Ward as Romana. I'm about to activate the randomizer again. I wonder where my time bubble will end up next. Will I be on a beach in Brighton, or will I be in Cambridge? I guess we'll find out next week.
I'm very glad you raised that, Mr. Floaty, because... as we all now know, this was Doug and Graham saying, okay, Tom, you want to run the story your way without a companion and just have it hilariously fun and jokes and japes for the kiddies and for everyone who loves you at home, and just have, you know, the Doctor being able to behave like this. This was to show him how awful, just again, another deadly assassin, how awful it would have been.
Mm.
So just as... Hinchcliffe had to do it for Assassin. We now have Williams and Douglas Adams showing him how it wouldn't have worked. And he still didn't get it. He said, oh, no, Lala doesn't love you. If you're going to have a companion, let them be the Doctor and I'll just have fun.
Yeah, so he just faffs about in the TARDIS for, like, scene after scene after scene.
It was deliberately done to give Tom his head so he'd shut up after seeing how awful it was. He didn't get it.
Actually a bit awful. Like, I love Tom. I think, you know, watching Tom on screen is fantastic. He's just mesmerising.
Can we do the noises? He's, the time rote noises.
There's a ruler twanging in there and all sorts of things.
It's actually the sound effect for Major Dennis Bloodnock's stomach.
It is!
From the Goon
really?
Show.
No, yes. It really is. Thank you, I've forgotten.
It's been put through a filter, but it is that sound effect. Yeah. Which
damn the curried watermelon.
Which, dear listener, you heard at the beginning of this episode.
Yes.
Yeah, I find Tom is actually really flat in those scenes. And I think, not that I'm blaming David Brierley, of course, but it's because he's bouncing off K-9. Tom is at his best when he has human actors to bounce off.
Or cabbages.
And, well, the thing is, we've seen so many times that Tom's performance and the level of Tom's performance depends on who he's acting with.
Yes, it really does.
You know, like when Julian Glover is playing everything so straight down the line in City of Death, Tom is, he's zany, but still does the zaniness on very one level. And, you know, oh, I'm just talking to you normally, and isn't that a wonderful Louis Cairns chair? Don't hit him over the head with it, dog. That sort of thing. Then you get him in the scene with Graham Crowden where he's talking about a black hole on my doorstep, and they're both amazing.
It's wonderful, isn't it? That is great.
Yeah. But it takes 40 minutes for the Doctor to get into the plot.
But, like, the cliffhanger to episode one is just terrible, and it's clearly meant to be so hilariously funny. It's coming for us, and then
it's coming right for us!
Yeah, that's right. And then he's protecting K-9, like, he's giving K-9 a hug and stuff, and it's just stupid.
It really is.
But the scene with Crowden later on is also super stupid and super silly, but it's much, much more entertaining to watch.
And despite the fact it's hilarious, it's still really menacing. Like, the way Graham Crowden says, a black hole on my doorstep.
Digging a black hole on my doorstep.
Yes. I mean, God, why wasn't he Ming the Merciless next year in Flash Gordon? As much as I love Max von Sydow. Oh, Max von Sydow?
Whatever you like. Yeah. He's a friendly chap. And in Star Wars.
Yes,
and
bless
in Star Wars. You could have had Graham Crowden. Graham Crowden is practically playing Ming the Merciless in this without the epicanthic folds. Mm. But he's great. And he's wonderful on the commentary. He barely remembers a bloody thing. Lala Ward's great on the commentary as well, because as soon as Sorak walks in, she says, and guest starring the Sydney Opera House!
I really wish more of their ad-libs had been kept in, because Lala's so good at all of that. And, you know, just with I would have liked Adams to have made a guest appearance in one of these stories.
Yeah, and another thing that Kate and Simon and Peter did on that fan edit is that every time the poor co-pilot speaks, as played by Malcolm Terrace, they would just superimpose the word oink underneath him in pink letters.
Well, that's kind of fat-shaming, really, isn't it?
It is, really, isn't it?
Also, the pilot, Bob Hornery, actually had quite a long career.
What's his real name?
He actually had quite a long career. And I can't remember who it was, but one of my old drinking buddies in the UK swore blind that he knew someone who played a pilot on Doctor Who. And then then came back to me a week later and, you know, he was saying, oh, you know, he was in this episode with Bulls and whatnot. I said, oh, is his name Malcolm? Oh, you know, it was a friend of the family. I'll have to go check. He came back. No, it was Bob. I'm like, what, Bob Hornery, the pilot? He said, yeah. And he always said that he was killed in episode one because he said he read the rest of the script and didn't want to be in it.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
You know, I doubt that's probably something you said after the fact.
No, honestly, Mum, that's why my career didn't work out. Can I have some more money?
Well, he actually had quite a long career playing civil servants and what have you. So he did a bit of an Alec Guinness, which is, oh, God, this is all a bit crap, isn't it? This will never go anywhere.
He was a bit of a that guy. He did look kind of familiar.
Yes.
Marlo Thomas of Doctor Who, you're saying. Yes.
I will say that the Nymon actors have wonderful names. We have Robin
bottoms.
Sheringham.
Lovely bottoms.
They have lovely bottoms, too. Mm. But we have Robin Sheringham. We have Bob Appleby. And we have Trevor St. John Hacker.
Yes.
Well, it's probably pronounced St. John Hacker.
Yeah, St. John Hacker. Dead butch names, all three of them. You know, they were dancers
they're all dancers.
They
dance. Yes.
Yeah.
I kind of want to cosplay.
Physical actor.
I kind of want to cosplay as a Nymon, despite the fact I'm 5'3".
Actually, that could be pretty hilarious.
You'd have to have 5 foot boots.
Yes. Yeah, so, well, I've got my Katie boots.
Yeah.
Just up the local shops. I mean, it doesn't have to be any event. Just go and
get a cosplay or
something. Go and get a beef souvlaki up the road. You know, something a bit thematic.
He has a name. So, Kenny McBain, directing his one and only Doctor Who story.
Yeah, because he dies almost immediately afterwards.
Shame.
Does he? I didn't realise.
He's dead by the age of 42.
Yeah.
He's quite young.
How awful.
Straight up. So, and so did Simon Gibbs Kent, who played Seth. He died in 1987. Of being in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And he's also in episode one of Blackadder, so he didn't die of shame. He did something good
before he
died.
I think he's quite good in this, yeah.
I think he was very popular.
He's a bit wet, but the character is a bit wet. And I'm quite sympathetic to, like, that bit in the first episode, I think it is, or the second episode, where he's telling Romana his story. I think he does that really well and really sells the idea that he's, you know, just been caught up in these circumstances and he doesn't feel like a hero, but he gets to be a hero in the end.
But he doesn't. I think that's the problem, is that to pay that scene off, he really needs to be the one. I know we don't do that in this era of Doctor Who, but he needs to be the one who actually does do something heroic at the end. But all he really does is run down a corridor with a stick and then run back when he sees some Nymons coming.
Well, he saves the Doctor from Soldeed in episode 4.
Yeah, no, he does. He does. So. And he sticks another
gun. He shoots
gun.
Soldeed, doesn't he?
Yes, another stick, another garnet in his massive wand. I do like that they're running about in their grandmother's curtains.
Is that the Von Trapp family?
They really are all wearing curtains. And I also like that they're the Enid Blyton youth characters in this. And Lala was always pushing for that. Oh, she wants more for the kids. But I think it plays nicely against the narrative. Visually, even though this is a cheap story, there are great things in it. Do you remember being 12 years of age and thinking how exciting the TARDIS has a vortex tunnel field effect that can extend the door force
field? That blew my mind.
That looked amazing at 12. And I've got to say, it still looks fine now.
Yeah, yeah. And
it's so exciting.
I mean, the model work sells it.
That's the kind of people we are.
The weird thing is, it's models on video again, but
yeah.
I think far more effective than the ones in...
I'm doing it now to Brendan's head.
I'm the asteroid, am I?
Yes.
Photo. The models are very effective. And you can tweet this straight away, Nathan. So when you hear this podcast in about 4 weeks, dear listener, you'll know what this tweet was all about. The models are really effective in that sequence, and Tom and Lala, they get the ramp at the perfect angle that they're walking down through the tunnel, and they're mucking about with the scarf. And yeah, it's another lovely moment. And despite
lots of lovely moments in this, aren't they?
Despite the fact, as Todd says, Tom is a bit out of control, he still gets his gravitas moment.
Yeah. Well, isn't he just balancing Soldeed?
Yeah, yeah, but that's the thing.
Performance-wise?
He's all jokes until that, now where's Romana?
And you get
the cold steel and the whole thing about...
Blue steel,
when he's angry about what the Nymon are doing and what have you. And I didn't mention last week with Nightmare of Eden, but, you know, that intensity at the end, go away.
That was quite good. Away. I liked that too.
That's the thing. I think Tom is a little bit out of control, but at the same time, he hasn't, say his predecessor, retired from acting.
No.
You know.
Yeah.
And as much as I love John, I don't think John retires from acting and stays retired. I think he retires from acting until he gets a moment he likes and then he comes back in full force. Whereas Tom is always full force, just not always going in the right direction.
You're
right, very different styles of performance. And there is petulance in Pertwee's performance, but then he is... an 18th century dandy, so that was part of the whole...
I mean, I think both of them are obnoxious to their co-stars from time to time.
Yes.
And I think both of them would have been really difficult to work with. Pertwee is acting sometimes, and Tom isn't. You know, Tom is a performance, but it's a compelling performance. Yeah. He's what you want to see on television. And so the character...
Millions did, didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, yeah. And the character doesn't have much interiority. You're not really invited to wonder how the Doctor's feeling at a particular moment.
Which we called mystery in those days.
Yes. So, but he's just really compelling to watch. And it does, as you say, Brendan, misfire from time to time. Sometimes it's embarrassing or it deforms a scene or something like that.
Yeah.
But he's so compelling to watch, and we're really at the tail end of a season where things are going to change really quite drastically in his performance after this.
I do wonder, and I haven't been able to find any strong indication of this, But they would have known that this story was going out over Christmas. Mm. And I think there is a definite effort to make it into a Christmas show. You know, to make it sparkly and to make it Panto-y.
I feel that. It's all denied, you know, in the later things. But come on, it was so long ago.
And
it is the first story of the 80s.
I usually have a festive, desiccated Anethan corpse in the corner of my living room.
Thank you for referencing that, because we're talking about all the lightness and silliness, but there is great chiaroscuro here. There's darkness as well. And, okay, Sol D doesn't necessarily get there, but, you know, a lot of this running out of time, Graham Crowthen's scenes were rehearsal shoots that he didn't think were going to be recorded. So when he giggles when he dies, of course he's laughing with Tom or whomever to start a shock. It's terrible, darling. and that happens quite a bit in this. But the corpse, it's totally Space 1979. It's this beautiful, think, desiccated corpse. And then you touch it and just like a lovely macaroon, it just... And it's still startling today.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Janet Ellis sells that moment.
I find
really
her
well.
Startling as well.
And then she actually gets the line of, you know, that's what's going to happen to us. We're going to become
my career.
Us.
That's right. Yes.
I saw Janet Ellis at a convention once.
Oh.
And it was very interesting because this was just after Blue Peter had been dropped to, I think, one episode a week, and the studio had been moved and cut and what have you. And Peter Purvis was at the same convention, and they were interviewed separately. And Peter Purvis
so
was.
Don't get on.
Peter Purvis. Was asked, what do you think of the move with Blue Peter? And he said, well, you know, with new media and internet and things, it's still relevant for children, but perhaps not as much as it was, and this could be a way to save the program. And if you distill the quality of two episodes into one really excellent episode, then I'm all for it. Whereas when Janet Ellis was asked, she said, no, they're trying to kill the program. So it's very interesting to get those two perspectives. Mm. But Janet Ellis also said...
I will have my revenge and have a daughter that will sing at you for... go on.
Someone said, have you shown Sophie Ellis Bextor your Doctor Who story? And she's like, oh, yeah. You know, she really likes the outfit. She wants to dress up like Romana. And she said, you know, it's fun because Sophie and I head out together and we go to karaoke bars and I embarrass her by singing her songs.
Do you know the other thing about Sophie Ellis Bextor? She's an out Doctor Who fan.
Oh, yeah.
She's actually said it. And even to the point that there are autons in Eclipse. There are other things. So way before Will Baker was doing it for, well, probably actually around exactly the same time. Sorry, Soph. That was doing it for Kylie. Mm. You've got, lots of Doctor Who references. Sophie, apparently, and this is just apocryphal, I don't know if any of you know the truth, was interested in being on the show.
But no, that's true.
But Russell was... they just didn't find a place for her, or...?
I think it was scheduling, because Janet did mention that in her interview, and she said, you know, Sophie wants to be on the show, and she's discussed it with them, but it was a matter of scheduling. Because despite the fact that we may not hear so much about Sophie these days...
She's coming out to Australia again.
Yeah. Exactly. She is still touring, and she is still putting out new music. It's just, you know...
Sounds exactly the same as it did 10 years ago, but she is still... I happen to have all of the tears, so, you know, I have no shame. But they're lots of lovely Doctor Who references. There are even lines in some of her songs. Oh, God, I'm tragic. That do reference Doctor Who.
There's that one line where she says she knows so little about telebiogenesis.
Yeah, that's the one. They're actually sound grabs from Tristram Cary on one of her tracks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I've got it here in the notes.
And that wonderful number 27 hit, Seth Will Defeat the Night Monarch, Restore Peace to Aneth.
Yeah.
For those of you who aren't aware, because I don't think we said it at the beginning, so the singer Sophie Ellis Bextor is the daughter of Tika actress Janet Ellis.
Yeah, and if you don't know that, why are you listening to this podcast? There's nothing else in it that'll make sense. There's nothing heterosexual in this entire four episodes, is there? There's absolutely nothing.
Somehow it manages to be incredibly camp and incredibly menacing at the same time.
Yes, are you saying they're in distinct properties? They're distinct properties? Are you saying they're distinct properties? I don't see.
No, it's just that quite often in television, when you get one, you don't get the other. You know,
as Mr. in life, as in art. Yes.
Mr. Humphreys was never particularly menacing.
Oh, I don't know.
Louis Fiander was never particularly menacing last week either, for the same reason.
But then every great villain in television and theatre history has been an evil camp old bugger.
That's true.
There is the child catcher.
Graf Vinda Kay.
Well, I don't know that that's necessarily our Venn diagram, is it?
He's definitely camp. You know he's having it off with Sherlock.
Oh, no, he might be gay, but he plays it so completely straight. I don't think there's a second of camp in there.
Tell me that glove slapping isn't camp.
All right.
Yeah, I think it's game, set, and match.
And you know, not only that, but he throws shade on Prentice Hancock.
Sure, shade.
What are you, impatient captain?
Oh, he's so great.
All right, we're abandoning Horns of Nymon and re-recording another Rebot Operation.
The WCB stories, whiny controlling bottom. You can really hear the graph just pushing for PCBs.
You know what? I really love this story, and the only reason I can sort of legitimize the hate that it gets is, you know what? Yes, it does look cheap. It's another cost-cutting exercise to pay for Sharda.
Sure.
You know,
well, I hope that works out.
Yeah, me too.
Sharda.
But that being said, I think the sets for this are so much better than the ones for Nightmare Eden, because, as I mentioned before, we have relief in the sets. Oh. We have levels to the sets. The designer is Graham Story on this one. You know, we have levels in the sets. We have things in the foreground. We have things in the background. Yeah, we have fake skies, but we've always had fake skies.
They're so strange. I mean, yeah. I like them a lot, but it is really, like, it's not naturalistic. They're not standing in buildings. They're standing on these sort of floors on the surface with these.
It's a Top of the Pops video.
It is, really, yeah.
Which is why I like it.
Or BBC Shakespeare did that as well.
But it's that hyper-naturalism to the point that it's surreal in itself.
Yeah.
It's not trying to be realistic. It's actually imitating other forms, and in this case, it's video pop.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, and I think it works really well. Yeah.
June Hudson was in on that one, don't you?
Yeah, she's crazy.
And of course, the Crinolt sets are a lot more realistic, if you like.
Yeah,
you
more don't, darkly lit.
More darkly lit, and you know, it's a complex with walls, and you don't see the fake sky.
Of that built just to avoid Victoria Waterfront.
And to give Tom a day off. But yeah, maybe that feeds into the idea of hyper-realism, because, you know, life on Skonos is great at the moment, and everything's hyper-real, and isn't it wonderful, and eat the Soylent, and have your cupcake in a cup, because you're going to be like this.
Mm. Or cream tea. Didn't you hear Skonos and just thought, oh, thank goodness, cream tea. Desperate for it. This is a lovely, lovely story. Mm. This is the last story of the 70s. One of these episodes went out
In the
January,
80s.
It's the first story of the 80s. I think it's a beautiful swan song to a magnificent era. And there's a lovely essay in License Denied, which is a collection put together by Paul Cornell that Nathan has cited previously, of just lovely things and fandom of this. When the 90s was re-looking at it. And one of them, my favourite essays is Why the Nymon is Our Friend. And it just talks about, as we did last time with Tom and Lala being the Doctor and Romana and facing off against the dreariness of the world by being individual and celebrating art and life and fun.
Yeah.
Celebrating fun. I actually think that's why Nightmare of Eden, as Nathan said, doesn't work, because its message is too pathetic, if you like.
Yeah.
Whereas this one is, oh, come on, don't be silly. Silly.
Yeah, this seems like the ultimate thing you were saying, you've been saying all of this season, Richard, of the individual against...
That's the thing, thank you. The individual against the doll ascribed. I actually say it's against capitalism.
Because, of course,
that's where he was coming from.
At this point... All of the humanoid characters in the story, the Skonons and the Anethans and the people of Krynoff, they're just being used for fuel.
Yes.
They have no life, they have no quality of life. Yeah. Even the Skonons, who are trying to build their empire, all they're living for is this empire, except for Sorak.
Do you feel it's a remake of that marvellous 1926 film Metropolis, which we should mention was made in German Expressionism?
where everyone's sort of part of a big giant machine.
Yeah. Expressionistically, so. Yeah,
and but the thing is,
I just said that because I wanted a reaction. you've
got Sorak. He's the one constantly asking questions. He's the one constantly asking questions. But why are we doing this? And isn't there something more?
Yeah. You know, and isn't there anything more to this?
You know, Soldeed can't revive K-9 because he's just doing it to get something he wants, whereas Sorak does it out of curiosity and manages to revive him, you know.
That's Sorak. Right. There's always the moment of hope and sentience in the individual. There's always a moment of we will transcend our current blandness by simply using our imaginations, simply thinking outside. Tom and Lala are just out now, of course, on Big Finish doing new series, the fifth series of Fourth Doctor.
Which is, reading. Isn't it wonderful?
Well, it's Justin Richards wrote a really whizzing script, and I'm not going to say who the villains are, but it feels like an Avengers story, and it's set in the 60s, and I thought, yes, this is how I felt looking at the Douglas Adams season. And for me, this is the Tom and Lala season. But we're not over yet, are we?
No, we're
we
not.
Kind of are. I mean, yeah. Aren't we? We really kind of are.
It depends how you look at canon.
I think it's a good place to reminisce about this season and the impact it had. That license denied... A collection has an article by Gareth Roberts called Tom the Second, which is a defence of this era. And his defence is that it's just terrifically fun.
Yeah.
And when we kind of do our Jenny Laird Awards and things next week, maybe I'll have criticisms to make. But I really enjoy just the tone, just the dialogue. There are so many funny throwaway lines all the way through, like this story and the last story and the previous one, which is just Douglas Adams. You know, you've got a brilliant, clever comedy writer doing the script editing, but a writer who is aware of the need to be serious and to be scary and to have something to say. And it just works really well. The relationship between Tom and Lala is great.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoy this. I'm not blind to its flaws, but gee, it's been fun.
And of course, depending on your version of canon, we will be doing Sharda next week, but some people don't count Sharda. And if you don't count Sharda, that means this is the last performance by David Brierley as K-9.
Yes.
Yeah. And his last line of dialogue, negative, Master. Poor thing.
Wow, I love David Brierley. He's wonderful.
You know what? I think he does. I think he does a great job. He makes the character his own. Well, you know, he carries on the idea of the character, but he doesn't try to just copy what John Leeson did, because I think it's far worse when a voice actor tries to copy exactly and gets it wrong than if they go, I'm going to go with the vague ballpark and get a similar kind of voice. Because he does end up with a similar voice. You can tell it's different.
You do know that K-9's computer brain has tarial cells in it, and so for this season he's under control by ORAC.
Oh my goodness.
Don't you think?
That makes perfect sense.
That's really happening.
I'm happy with that. Well done. Like so much of this season, despite each of the stories has flaws, as we've discussed, you can put on any of them and have a good time.
Yeah,
like a frock.
As we blast off from Skonos with our ship painted white...
I hope we remember to do that.
We're going to set the randomizer, and as Todd said earlier, we may end up in Cambridge or we may end up in Brighton. No, we're going to Cambridge. Please check out our website at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. You can also share this podcast that you've just listened to on your social networks. That would be wonderful. And check out Bondfinger as well, where we have 6 Bond commentaries. Until next week, may all your power complexes fit. Thank you very much and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Despicable Worm, Weakling Scum, and Meddlesome Hussy. This episode, Falling on Corey Bernardi, was recorded on the 6th of February 2016. The next episode will be released on February 28th. This episode is dedicated to Bob Hornery, who in fact had a 60-year career and passed away last year in Melbourne.
Horns of Nymon, February 6th.
No, it's the Horns of Nymon.
Keep that in.
The previous one was Anarthrus. This one has the article. It's my job to know that.
Yep. And you can put that up your Anarthrus. Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who... I dried and then a car horn. Right, okay.